We love supporting and promoting the creators of musical theater throughout the world, and we would love to have your support as well. Go to musicaltheaterradio.com and click on the Become a Patron button, because a supportive community is a strong community. Welcome back to another episode of Be Our Guest here on Musical Theater Radio. I am your host, as always, Jean-Paul Yovanoff. I love discovering new stuff, new shows, new cast recordings. New is the best. And about a month ago, the live cast album of It Happened in Key West got its digital release from Broadway Records. Today's guest was a part of that original cast, plus two other shows I actually play on the station, Ernest Shackleton Loves Me and Triassic Park. So let's dive right in with our guest and get to know Wade McCollum. Wade, hello.
Hello, Jean-Paul. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for taking time out of your busy day to talk to me. I know you're on the road in a show, so thank you.
Yeah, this is great.
Awesome. So before we talk about It Happened in Key West and little other stuff, let's get to know you a little bit better. I always ask my guests to give their 30-second bio. So in 30 seconds, who is Wade?
Ooh, that's difficult. Let's see. Born on the road in a rock and roll band. Spent part of my childhood in Ashland, Oregon, home of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, which is why I'm an actor. Been an actor since I graduated PCPA at 19. Interested in science and interested in brain science and neuroscience and how it all fits together, and storytelling and narrative, and a writer, a composer, a multi-hyphenate, a co-founder of tech companies, and also loves to sing. And I'm on tour with My Fair Lady. That's all.
You are a Renaissance man with all that stuff. Nice. So let me take it back a bit. Were you always interested in musical theater growing up? And were you the black sheep of the family? Or is this something that everyone does there in your family?
Well, so because I grew up in rock and roll, music was sort of the fabric of how people made a living. So nobody could tell me you couldn't make a living doing music. But musical theater was a very foreign concept. And theater in general, because of the kind of financial universe that we lived in, was not accessible to me. It wasn't a thing we did. It was a thing that rich people did. And so I didn't see a play or a musical or anything until probably, it was at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, and it was Major Barbara, a Bernard Shaw play. Wow. And I fell deeply in love. And now I'm doing this Bernard Shaw play, you know, getting to do Henry Higgins on occasion, which is just incredible. So that's kind of a cool full circle moment. But I would say black sheep, I don't know about that, because they love music and, you know, they honor what I'm up to. But I certainly didn't come from a long lineage of musical theater people.
I'm very curious about how many people could say that Barbara Shaw was the gateway, Major Barbara was the gateway play to theater for them.
You're right. I bet maybe just me.
Shaw's out there going somewhere. Wow. Awesome.
Somebody did Major Barbara. Great.
So did you always want to be in the arts, or like you were saying, you tech company and tech stuff and neuroscience? So when you were going through school, was there another path you were thinking you might end up going?
Yeah. So I was one of those weirdo kids who kind of was a lot of very, very intensely curious and sort of hyper-focused on certain things. And I got very, very interested in math and science when I was about, I don't know, 8. And I went down a deep mathematics wormhole. I got into algebra. And at the time, you know, in the 80s, there wasn't the internet. So I only had what was in front of me, which was this elementary school. And nobody was really paying attention to me at that time. I was an only child and my mom was working all the time as a single mom. So I was sort of left to my own devices. And because of that, I didn't have the sort of propulsive resources to keep going in science and math. And so I was told I had to wait for the rest of the class, which, you know, didn't really happen until seventh or eighth grade, where algebra became a thing. And so ultimately, I sort of put that scientist math person to bed and said, I'll meet you later, maybe. And I disappeared into my imagination because stories were a place where I could go as deep and as long and as far and as complex and as nuanced and as layered as I wanted to, and nobody could sort of put a cap on it. And so it was in my imagination that I sort of found this limitless exploration that really satisfied that urge in me. And then it wasn't until, you know, seeing a play that I was like, oh, maybe there's like a plug-in for this imaginative impulse in me. I can actually like be a community, be with people while I do that. And I have to admit, it was like most theater people, it was like finding your tribe. And it absolutely 100% saved my life, you know, and it was from then on. So yes, there was an alternate track that had I grown up in different circumstances, I might be a physicist. I really love astrophysics. And the pandemic provided this opportunity for me to apply to University of Pennsylvania for a neuroscience program and sort of nurture this science part, because, you know, I was writing and stuff, but we couldn't perform. So I had all this free time and energy on my hands. So I was like, hey, third grader scientist, wanna come play for a while? And, you know, and it's been neat. I got to meet myself, my science self, and now I'm sort of like on a long trajectory of perhaps a PhD in the neuroscience of imitation, which I think is, you know, I'm really interested in studying actors' brains and kind of the superpowers that actors have, from, you know, emotional recall to, you know, just sort of the gymnastics of performing 8 shows a week, where you're, you know, re-experiencing perhaps very traumatic things or very, very stressful, both as a performer and as a character. And where does that live in the brain? And how does it all work? And how can we give tools to the rest of humanity?
I think that's fantastic. Well, first of all, congratulations on doing that during the pandemic and putting that together and doing that. So first, yeah, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
No problem. And I love when I meet people who diversify themselves. You know, a lot of people, you hear a lot in sports and then the arts, they concentrate on one thing, like either hockey, baseball, singing, whatever it is. But it's the people who diversify themselves and put that stuff just off to the side and learn something else that make them a whole person. And I think better performers and better writers and better stuff like that. So you do the right thing, I think. And that's fantastic that you do that.
Oh, thanks for saying that. Yeah, I'm having a lot of fun. So if that counts for anything, I'm having a great time. And it all goes together. You know, I feel like they're mutually supportive endeavors.
And sometimes just having fun makes the biggest difference.
It's so stress, true. Right?
So did you go to college anywhere or university for theater, or what did you do with yourself?
Yeah, so they sort of took me out of normal, quote, normal school in the 6th grade. And I got put in sort of a self-motivated or self-driven curriculum where they just sort of said, what are you interested in? And at that time, I went down a debate wormhole, sort of speech and debate, and got very interested in ethics and politics and in the environment, and went on to be sort of a national debate champion very, very quickly as a freshman, or in my first year of what I was calling high school. And then when I found the theater, which was about freshman, sophomore year, it really all came. I performed in my first play, Company of Wayward Saints by George Herman, directed by the absolutely incredible Kirk Boyd, who was the associate artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival at the time. And he came to direct a play at our high school. And through a bunch of kismet and synchronicities, I ended up accidentally auditioning, like walking down the hall during the auditions. And a friend said, walk in this door. And it just happened. And it absolutely 100% changed the course of my life forever. And once I found theater, I thought, oh, this is my job. This is what I do for the rest of my life. There was no doubt. And so I very quickly dropped out of the high school situation. I wasn't really interested in graduating that anyway, and had teachers saying, you need to go to college because the dialectic or debate you're interested in having about US history, we cannot actually have here in the high school curriculum. And so I did, I dropped out and I got into PCPA, which is this beautiful 2-year actor training program in California. And luckily they accepted me as a youngin, and I went in, and it was just the perfect sort of, it was, they treat it like a trade school. You go in and you learn how to be a professional actor. They give you the tools, and there's not a lot of fluff. And it's, you know, it's a 6 day a week rigorous training program, and you're performing at this big regional theater at night, or rehearsing with your teachers. And so you get to sort of see your professors put into action what they're attempting to teach you how to do in the daytime, in the class setting. So it's this really amazing program. I graduated that at 19 and then just have been acting. So it really was a perfect choice for me at the time. And now I can't remember what your question was. I did go to that college.
Sometimes I don't remember either. You know what? We enjoyed the journey, whatever it was from there to now. So, but there's going to be a trend right now. You did a lot of plays. When did you do your first musical? Was it after college? Was it before?
No, I think it was during that high school moment. I did... It was Once Upon a Mattress.
I know that show.
Is that true? I think it might be true that I played Prince Dauntless. I think that was, I've never even thought about that.
It's not on your resume. I noticed that.
No, I've taken the high school shows off. Yes.
But that actually, that's one of the shows I got on. I was playing Prince Dauntless too. That's a
Oh my gosh. Oh, that's so cool. We have that in common. Yep. I love that.
It is such a fun show.
It's a great little show. Yeah.
Cool. So you were in California. Did you stay in California? Did you move out east to New York, as lots of people do?
So again, this was a resource thing. I didn't have the resources to go to New York.
Yeah.
I through college lived in my car, and, you know, through the kindness of strangers and some great scholarships, was able to sort of float myself. But, you know, I don't come from any sort of situation where there was any sort of resources to do anything like that. I always had dreams like, oh, I'll go to Yale and all blah, blah, blah. So to be in that circumstance right now is quite a dream come true. Yeah. But at the time, no, I just was like, what's my next job? Gig, which is what I watched my father do as a drummer, just gig, you know, gig for a living. And so that was what I went to do. And so, no, I graduated, I went to Portland, Oregon, because I had some friends up there and some family. And I got into Blood Brothers, was my first out of college professional musical. And then shortly ended up doing Hedwig and the Angry Inch up there, which was what sort of catapulted me into a different sort of echelon. And during that period, I've always been super audacious and maybe slightly foolish, maybe innocent. I don't know what the word is, but I just was like, I thought, you know what, I'm going to open a theater company. I was probably, 22, 23. Yeah. Does anybody have a nonprofit? And my friend Matt did, and I had written a musical based on Siddhartha, the Hermann Hesse novel, that he was working on with me. And he said, you know what, I've been running this theater company for a while, and we're sort of running out of steam. Do you want to just do a friendly takeover of the 501c3? I said, well, this is a sign from the universe. Absolutely. So I did. I got a board of directors together. We got some co-founders, and we just opened a theater company. And I wanted to tell stories of the oppressed, you know, unheard tales, and sort of shine light on the people who don't have the resources to have their stories told. And it was really fun, and it was really amazing. We went from, you know, a very sort of meager, small, interesting, and wonderful, modest budget of, I don't know, $10,000 the first year, and did a few productions, to by our fourth year, we were, you know, $500,000 a year operating budget. And it, you know, it started to really build momentum. And that was sort of part of my early 20s as well. But the performing sort of took the front burner as those things sort of went down simultaneous tracks. The performing kind of kept pulling me out of being, of good service as an artistic director. So I ended up in New York in 2007 because I had gone to LA for Hedwig, doing a production of Hedwig in Los Angeles, which won all these awards. And then I got a Jersey Boys, the Chicago company of Jersey Boys, which was the third production of Jersey Boys. And I went to New York for that to rehearse. And it was my first time really ever going to New York City. And I was what, 30, almost 30? And somebody flew me there. I was like, I've got the resources.
It's always nicer when somebody flies you, right? It's so much
Yes.
better.
Yes, got that Broadway money.
like I said, I want to work my way to the Key West because you were on a couple of other cast recordings as well. Which one did you do first, Ernest or Triassic Park?
Triassic.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, what a cool show. I want to do that again. We almost did a concert
Oh,
last
really?
summer.
Oh.
Radial Park, Radiant Park in Queens. We're going to do like a reunion concert. Oh, it was so exciting. And for, I think, COVID reasons, it got
Yeah.
canceled. But I just adore that show. It deserves more attention. That was first. That was after I led the Priscilla Queen of the Desert tour. And then I got back to town and quickly went into playing the matriarchal Velociraptor in a rock musical of Jurassic Park, which is what one does,
Yep.
obviously, after you do Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Yep.
Yeah, met a lot of cool, wonderful, lifelong friends in that project. And Lindsay Nicole Chambers actually played my sister slash father of my child. Very complex Grecian tale
Yep.
of mythic proportions that dinosaur tale is. And we were already friends from doing submissions only. So it was really fun to jump into that zany musical together and get to do that together. So that happened, and then Ernest Shackleton happened a couple few years later after several out of town tryouts and development stages.
People should definitely check out those two shows. Go online, find them, listen to the radio station to hear them as well. But yeah, go check those out. They're very cool, especially the Triassic Park one. It's just, yeah, very interesting. So let's get into this latest cast recording that just dropped, about a month ago as of this recording. It happened in Key West. Tell us a little bit about the show.
Oh, this is another like really incredible, layered, bizarre, beautiful piece of work. I was drawn to it because it is such a strange story. And there's so much challenge involved in sort of unpacking and telling the tale. This was a true story. And where to even begin? For me, my entry point was sort of the love story was so unexpectedly moving, and the music is so incredibly rich and romantic and has this golden era sweeping classic sound. But it's paired with this very macabre tale. On the outside, it's a very macabre tale about sort of death and grief and true love, and brings up all sorts of questions about the notion of soulmates and the notions of death and life after death, and then also for me about neurodivergence and promises kept and how far is too far in keeping a promise. And so I have a lot of empathy for the characters in the play. That's generally my MO with characters, is to sort of really listen to what they say and try to understand and not judge too harshly. But there is a lot of material in this story that's really bizarre and hard not to sort of, think, what the? So yeah, so it's a true story about a man who had a dream of his soulmate when he was 12 years old, and his psychic grandmother in Germany in the 1800s said, "You have to find her. She's your soulmate." And he fixated on this notion. I believe he was, an autistic fellow, and had 12 degrees, very intelligent, super interesting person. And he traveled the world searching for his soulmate. That was his, above all, that was his main focus. And he ended up in Key West, Florida through because of a hurricane, actually. He crashed on the island, got a job at the hospital as a radiologist. And now this is 40 years after he had that dream. And this woman from the dream walks through the door of his radiology clinic. And he's gobsmacked. And of course, there's a bunch of challenges. She happens to be dying of tuberculosis being the biggest challenge. She's also much younger than he, and she's married. And so it maybe it's not meant to be, but he can't sort of understand how that's possible. So he sort of enlists all sorts of scientific methods that were very sort of innovative at the time to try to save her life of tuberculosis. And he does extend her life, and he's the only person who will actually be near her because everybody's afraid, obviously. Her husband abandons her. And so they become friends, nothing more, but they have a deep connection and they become very close, and she becomes very fond of him. And she, you know, the people who are alive who knew her said that she said, you know, if it were different circumstances, maybe we could have been married, but obviously that's not meant to be in this particular lifetime. She did ask him, she made him promise to take care of her after he died. And so when she did die, he did that. And for some reason, he thought that that meant that, you know, he had a dream again that she said, take me home. I don't want to be buried underground. They got married, their spirits got married in the graveyard. This is all by his account. And the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful songs I've ever had the pleasure of singing in my entire life is called Undying Love. And it's the wedding in this graveyard. And it's Carl Tanzler marrying the spirit of Elena Hoyos in the Key West graveyard, which I went and visited recently. And it's so interesting. And then, you know, he takes her casket home, and they'd like to say that, you know, it's like the greatest fixer up project in history. He restores her body, and it's such an amazing restoration that when they do end up finding her, she gets put on display. Thousands of people come and pay money to see the body. And it jumpstarts tourism in Key West in the 30s. So he sort of became this like hero, anti-hero, very complicated weirdo who kind of helped Key West in a really sort of not helpful way. and for me, I just really feel like he was fulfilling his promise to her. And that's where I, you know, my question is, you know, how far is too far? And for me, it's a conversation around mental health and love, and the insane things people do for love. And in this case, you know, he did something extraordinary and odd, but it certainly wasn't what he signed up for. He wasn't looking to do that. It was something he felt she asked him to do. And so he was trying to bring her back to life so that they could live their lives. And so it's a very sad, but also very beautiful story in lots of ways, but it's very complex.
It would be, I wish I'd been able to see that. That would be, it's just kind of bizarre. It's just this love, macabre, just strange stuff. And yeah, I would love to have seen it. And where did you guys performed it in the UK, correct? In London?
Yeah, so we did a really beautiful West End production, and it was very well received, and the cast was incredible. And this cast album is a live cast recording. So one night they recorded it. It sounds beautiful. When I heard live cast album, I was nervous because, well, who knows how you sounded that night? And yeah. What about audience reaction? And what about all these different questions I had in terms of the liveness and the quality? But wow, they've done an amazing job. The recording itself is really, really high quality. And what I love most about it is it captured the live performative quality, which for me, the other cast recordings, you're sort of trying to redo that. You're in a studio setting. You're not even really able to see your scene partner. You're kind of, you know, just singing through the music and imagining yourself in the circumstances. Whereas this, it captured us doing the play, and we happen to be singing the play, and it's, you can hear it, and it's really, really cool to feel that performative quality.
Did they tell you they were recording it? Or did they just do it and say, hey, by the way?
They did tell us. And actually, okay, you know, part of me wished they had not told, right, because then you're just kind of doing your job. But yeah, then all of a sudden you're like, oh, there's a microphone on.
Exactly. Because, yeah, for me, I'd be like, yeah, I wouldn't want to tell you, because then all of a sudden you have this other second thing in your head that you got to worry about. Did they just do one night recording, or did they do a couple of nights and then splice them together? Do you know?
I actually don't know the technical wizardry. Okay. I'm not certain. I don't know.
Okay.
But whatever they did, it sounds really good. I'm very proud of them.
And I assume they flew you over from the States with that West End money.
Yeah, so. West End money.
So was the cast made up of lots of different people from the UK, from the US? What was that casting like?
So I was the only chap from the United States. It's hard to get American performers over to London in the West End. There's a lot of hoops to jump through in terms of the visa, work visa stuff. Yeah. So I was really grateful for that. That was really, really a dream come true. I mean, what? And the West End community is just incredible. So everybody was citizens of London, but a lot of people were immigrants, because the show is really populated with mostly Cuban American characters. And so we had a really, really cool international cast. There was people from Portugal and people from Cuba and people from Argentina and people from all over the world. And it was, but they were all, you know, officially citizens. So yeah, I thought it was really fun. They were a really cool group.
I'm always interested in hearing, did you notice a difference in audiences? You've played in the States, you've played in the UK. What differences do you find between American and British audiences?
Yeah, I feel like the British audiences, because theater is so woven into the fabric of their society, it's much more of a pedestrian event. It's just a thing you do. It's like bread and butter. You go to the theater. It's a thing that you inherit that as a tradition. You just do that. Whereas I feel like in the States, it's a very special thing. You like, you know, because, and I think, you know, I've experienced this in lots of us firsthand, where you got to save your coin in order to go to a show. It's expensive. And so the access points are different. And so, you know, maybe a family from, you know, the middle of the country here in the States, they save up and they go see one Broadway show a year, and it's a big event. And, you know, in the West End, it just feels sort of like people come way more regularly. And so with that said, it just feels like, because they're constantly in the theater, it feels like there's just they're more sort of theater savvy. And I don't mean that in like a higher or lower or judgy way of an American crowd. It just feels like some of the theater is just more comfortable to them. And so, yeah, things land differently. And there are a lot of cultural differences, of course, and the humor is different. So things did land differently.
Yeah.
And that's beautiful.
I find that here in Canada, because we share a border with you guys in the States, but our heritage is also British. So I fall both of them. I'm like, oh, hey, I can swim in both swimming pools. But yeah, it's very interesting when you talk about that. That's very cool. How long did it run in the UK?
We ran 3 months, 4 months. Yeah. Yeah, it was a really robust run. And it was, you know, what was really interesting about the moment that we went to London was, and this is one thing, you know, zeitgeist is a thing that I think has a lot to do with how a show is received. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think as artists, we're always sort of, at least I can speak for myself. I'm always, as a writer, I'm always, curious about what it is, what I might be saying that I'm not intending to say, and that there are, you know, perhaps positive and negative outcomes on how that plays out. And so I feel like in London we discovered certain things about the play that were unintentional. and then figured out ways in this. We just did a workshop in Pennsylvania at Bristol Riverside, and we figured out how to sort of mitigate the things we were trying not to say and augment a bunch of things that we are trying to say with the piece. So that was one really sort of helpful discovery that was made along the way. And it mostly, well, almost entirely had to do with Elena's character and her sense of agency. And it's a really hard story to tell, because you're dealing with a person and she spends half of the play not alive, but she's in the play.
Yeah.
And she's very much alive in Carl's universe, you know? And so how to sort of paint that character is it's an ambiguous question. And so we got this new amazing director, Rebecca Martinez, and she just, there was so much wonderful, beautiful, sensitive insight, and also, you know, her Cuban heritage, and really honoring who she is and how they meet, and how we kind of ask the question for ourselves and the audience, are they soulmates? And really sort of see the potential for that, you know, maybe not in this lifetime, but maybe out of this lifetime.
Mm. So is there, I don't know if you could say, is there an upcoming production maybe happening in the States somewhere, or it's just being worked through still and working on things?
So our producers are fantastic. And yes, there is a lot of momentum and drive toward the next step. And there will most certainly inevitably be next steps here in the States, which I'm very excited about. And the rewrites are beautiful. They're beautiful. Yeah.
Very cool. Well, we'll have to keep an eye on that. And if it does happen, you'll have to let us know, because we will promote the heck out of it.
Oh, thank you.
Make sure it happens. So what's happening with you? What's going on with Wade right now? What's the future looking like for him?
I mean, as I think you've probably figured out, I have a lot of, you know, a lot of projects on a lot of burners in a lot of different areas. But so we closed the Lincoln Center Theater My Fair Lady tour in mid-August, and then I'll go back to New York. And I've been working on this film. It's a dance film, experimental narrative film, for several years now. And we hit a bunch of technical snafus over the pandemic, and we just sort of crossed that threshold and got all of our corrupted files back. And so we got the rough cut about 4 days ago, and it's absolutely incredible. And I'm so proud of it. And I'm so excited to share it with the world. And so that film, we are submitting to Sundance in a couple of weeks. And I'm really hoping we can give that to the world, because it's beautiful. And the music in the film is gorgeous. So that's one cool project I have sort of coming up with some inevitability. And then there just feels like this incredible, you know, a lot of potentiality. I just did the Pal Joey revival pre-Broadway work session with Savion Glover and Tony Goldwyn, with this incredible cast. And Richard Lagravenez is rewriting the book. And it's just, you know, really, 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 really cool reimagination of Pal Joey. And, you know, how can we tell that story in a responsible way? And they're doing incredible work. So that was really fun. You know, we'll see what happens with that. They've got their plans. But yeah, I'm just kind of going back to the city, and there's a lot of potential what ifs in the field. And I feel a real sense of excitement and trust about the future.
That's our industry, right? You never know. And you just go out and do it. And It happens, and you just keep trying. And so congratulations on It Happened in Key West, the other shows, the Sundance. Let's hope that happens and it gets in there, and everything else you've got going on. So Wade, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us a bit about yourself and the shows.
Thank you for having me.
No problem. But before we go, I always ask three questions of my guests. There's no right or wrong answer. But the listeners are judgy, so I'm not, but they are sometimes. So whatever you say, you're going to offend somebody.
Isn't that the truth?
All right. So question number one, What creator or team within musical theater has had a great influence on you? No, it could be a composer, lyricist, director, producer, actor, even stage manager. It could be somebody famous or not famous, like a teacher. Is there somebody who's had a great influence on you?
I'm bad with superlatives, so I'm going to have to probably choose for, I would say, Sondheim. I know that's cliche, but how can you not?
I know.
I would say Stephen Trask and John Cameron Mitchell. Wow, Hedvig really altered the course of my career, and that material has informed me in so many different ways. And Kirk Boyd from the Oregon Shakespeare Festival as a mentor and as a teacher in my early career, who really helped inspire and guide me.
Nice. Yeah, lots of people said Sondheim, but you did. I love when people say somebody that not everybody may know, right? Like you said, because everybody has some kind of influence on you, whether they're somebody famous or not. And I love appreciating those type of people. So 1 point, 1 point. All right. Question number two. Let's see. Ernest Shackleton led an expedition to Arctic. Arctic. Keen West is in Florida. Are you a hot or cold man when it comes to climate and where to live?
Oh, that's a good question. So, wow, I'm like, I feel like I live on the extremes. I really like Florida and sort of a hot environment, but I love swimming in ice water. So I recently posted a picture of me chopping through the ice in a lake upstate where we were living on this cabin upstate, and chopping through the ice so that I could get in to go swimming. I love cold water. Huh. I'm just like really into it. And so I think if I had to choose, if I just had to stay in one place, yeah, I'd probably choose a hot environment, just because it feels like, welcome outside, human. Whereas when it's always cold, it's like, don't be out here, human. But I do love a cold swim. So in an ideal world, it would be a very hot setting with a very cold lake.
Let's see. Is there a place where you could do that? I'm trying to think. Probably not, but one point.
Climate change, you never know.
At this point, yeah. Who knows? You could probably go up to the Arctic soon and it'll be warm and cold at the same time. So, all right, another point. Congratulations. Third question, the one where people might, say stuff. Food in the theater or cell phones in the theater, which is worse?
Oh, gosh. because I just did this one person show in Portland, Oregon, called Confessions of Mr. Madam, another historical figure, played 35 characters, and that is also coming to New York. I have to say that it, through the course of that show, and it being a one-person show, it's very sort of quiet, and there's nobody to share the, oh my gosh, can you believe this is happening with?
Yeah.
And I think food, because throughout the course of the run, cell phones would go off, and sometimes it was a funny thing that I could incorporate into the play. Sometimes it was just easy to ignore. Everybody knows what it is. But the food, sometimes people would just sit there and crinkle. On closing night, a woman was like eating chips in the second row, like a loud bag of chips, and the bag was crinkling, and then she was crunching. And I almost went out and asked for one, because it sounded so delicious, but it just went on and on. Unlike a cell phone, I feel like maybe it happens once and then it's over. Yeah. Those chips lasted through like 10 minutes of the play. So I'm going to say food.
I would have also accepted both are terrible. So still get a point. So 3 out of 3, congratulations. I don't know where you can spend these points, but you can brag to everybody.
Hey, that's worth a lot.
Again, Wade, thank you so much for coming on. All the best with everything, and I look forward to seeing where you take all your endeavors in the future.
Thank you, and ditto, and we love your show, Matinee Radio. So incredible. Musical Theater Radio, incredible, incredible, incredible.
Thank you so much. All right. We were just speaking with Wade McCollum, who was in the latest release of about a month ago, the live cast recording of It Happened in Key West. Make sure you check that out. You can find that wherever streams are and things like that. And then come back to the radio station, of course. My name is Jean-Paul Yovanoff. And as always, we'll tune in next week. We'll have another guest or guests talk about the life, love, and passion that is musical theater. And until then, I'll see you when I see you.